My only question to you on this Wednesday night live at freedomain.locals.com is, have you, you right there, don't move. Have you read or listened to my book, The Future? Not in the future, but right now. Yes. Good. Anybody else? Yes, yes, yes. Yes, God, oh yes, yes. I thought we could ask you anything. You can. You can ask me if I would like to ask you if you read my new book. Make the future your past, I had that nice thing. Make the future the present. That would be a good slogan. But of course, you'd have to read the book to know what the hell that meant. So good, good, good. Did you like it? Did you find it helpful, valuable, useful, interesting, engaging? Whatever you like. Yes? Good. Yeah, I did two call-ins today, plus a show tonight. And one of the listeners was really praising the book, and I just wanted to. Way better than Ayn Rand. Ooh, you tickle me in my G-spot. So thank you. Yes, thought-provoking. The greatest of all your books. I take that as a challenge. I take that as a challenge. Thank you. That's very kind. I appreciate that. And yeah, it was 40 years in the making. So if it sucks, that's on me. Look at that. Do you see? I got non-reflective glasses. I'm very excited. All right. You guys ask away. Def, your best work yet. Thank you. Do you plan to release a book on parenting? I just did. The audio is over the top. Voice is unreal. It's, you know, I wish I had been gifted with a slightly better singing instrument, but I got to tell you, for audiobooks, I have a great vocal ability for audiobooks. Now, of course, I took voice training for a couple of years in school and all of that. Is there any other subject you would like to write a novel about aside from peaceful parenting? Well, yeah. I mean, I've got other ideas for novels. I'd love to write one set in the late Roman Empire. It would be a good way to get modern life across to people in a fictional format. I'd also like to do a novel about the descent of atheists into nihilism and its rescue through philosophy. So, yes, there is a lot. There is a lot. How can I get better at picking friends? I have been abandoned and betrayed too much. It's funny, I just had a call today. I'm not giving away any secrets because you'll hear it in the accent when it gets released. With an Irish fella who, when he started questioning his family, ended up being ditched by all of his friends. So you must improve your bust. And you must also pick your friends based on shared values. Shared values. Absolutely essential. Really, that is friendship. That's what friendship is. And there's no other substitute. There's nothing else that can occur in the realm of friendship other than shared values. Truth, reason, evidence, virtue, UPB, universal morality, whatever it's going to be. You must relentlessly, don't let history pick your friends. Don't let circumstances pick your friends. Don't let looks, don't let cool, don't let parties, don't let anything choose your friends except virtue. Now, if you choose your friends based on virtue, integrity, honor, courage, they will not abandon you because you share virtues, and therefore to abandon you would be to abandon their values. So, yeah, there is no substitute for love. All right. How and when do you give your kids unstructured play in the current age? Just let them out of the house. Let them roam around. So, you don't give your kids unstructured play, you just let them play. You often mention your Revolutions novel. Where can I find it? The premise is very interesting. Yeah, I should do something. I've got that book in. I was thinking of doing it as an audiobook. It's my first real novel that I wrote when I was about 25, and I'd give it a solid 8 out of 10. For me, almost is 10 out of 10, to go is 9 out of 10, and The Future is 11 out of 10, but I should do something with it for sure. All right. I've always found greed to be a midwife, thought avoidant, non-answer to bad things. Is there anything to psychology and philosophy with greed's incentives more greed or incentives, more practical lens. You remind me of, I mean, the future for me, like the book, The Future, full of so many great quotes, but I will give you one and then I will use it as a foundation. Don't you hate it when you open up, you open up something, you want to do a search, but it doesn't put you in the search window. It puts you, so you end up typing in the text. It's really bad. Why can't Outlook close? Do you guys have this? Like, why getting Outlook to close is like a freaking demonic exorcism. Like, its head is going to spin. I just close Outlook. No. You can't close it. What you can do is hide it in the background tiles. You can't close it. That requires four priests and holy water and Bill Gates to give up his depopulation agenda, apparently quite impossible. You can't close Outlook. You can't close Outlook. How many times do you just have to go into Task Manager and say, oh, kill whatever's Outlook related so it can start again and say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't close. I closed it. No, I'm not going to close. What I'm going to do, I'm going to move to the background. I'm going to force you to close me that way. But then when I restart, I'm going to say, oh, sorry, Outlook didn't close, man. You broke it somehow. It's your software, Billy boy. Why is that? Why is that? Anyway, let me see if I can find it. All right, I may need to switch glasses. Hold on a sec. There we go. Those are the close-up peepers. Ah, yes. This is a rather satanic character who gives away things for free through politics. He says, I charge for what people demand. They want free things. They know I take from others. And they genuinely seem to believe that there will never be a price. That's the wild effect of the fall of religion. No one believes they have a soul anymore. So no one knows how much will be paid for greed. I never take anything that is not willingly offered. Everyone knows there is no such thing as a free lunch. Beg to have something for nothing. You become nothing. I don't empty people out. I just collect the bill. Anyway, this is the ruminations of a politician. So greed is what? Greed is desire for the unearned. Greed is desire for the unearned. So think of greed for food. So greed for food occurs because we all do this. Everybody on the planet does this. We say, I've been good. I deserve a treat. I feel bad. I deserve a pick-me-up. I've worked hard. I deserve a muffin or a cupcake or whatever it is, right? Everybody does this. We train ourselves with food. The only true happiness that we have and that lasts is through virtue, not through cupcakes. Cupcakes are not an avenue through which you can pass to the Elysium fields of virtuous happiness. So if you want to be happy and you won't do the work to be honest and have integrity and challenge evildoers and support good people and all that, if you want to be happy and you are greedy for happiness but you don't want to do the hard work, you treat yourself. You train yourself like a puppy or a cat, right? And poop in the box or poop outside, right? If a woman is feeling insecure, what does she do? Does anybody know what women do often when they feel insecure, when they're young? Anybody? Bueller? Anybody know? What do women do? get on Tinder for likes. Lipstick. Absolutely. Yeah. So what women, there's a scene in a show called Homeland where Claire Danes is suicidal. And what she does is she dresses up sexy to go out. And that's how she's going to combat her suicidal feelings. So for a woman who wants to feel pumped up and happy and positive, what she does is she goes trawling for male attention. Wear leggings. Yeah. Put your tits on a shelf, put your ass on heels, and off you go, right? And then she gets male attention. Oh, now, it used to be you'd have to go out. Now you just go on Tinder or whatever. And she gets male attention. And that's great. I want to feel good, but I don't want to do the work of virtue and the challenge of integrity to feel good. So I'm just going to get endorphins from male lust. I want to be a magnet for the endless flesh antennae of male lust. That's right. Steph Bott might be feeling just a tiny bit poetic tonight. So we'll have a great show. So greed. We can be greedy for absolution, for the avoidance of consequences for our actions, right? A woman has a child with a man who's a bad father. He doesn't stick around. He's not reliable. He's not, doesn't have a job. He, whatever, right? It's a huge mistake, catastrophic mistake. And she is desperate, desperate to avoid the consequences. She's greedy to avoid the consequences. So she shoulders the taxpayers with the burdens as a whole. So greed for the unearned. You want unearned forgiveness? People are greedy for unearned forgiveness, right? So what do? They wrong you, and you say, hey, that was unkind. And they say, sorry. And you say, that doesn't feel very good. Hey, I said I was sorry. What more do you want from me? I can't turn back the time. I can't make things not happen that happened. I made a mistake. I'm sorry. Do you want me to grovel? Do you want money? I'm sorry. Right? They're very aggressive because they want forgiveness without contrition, without recompense, right? So they want the unearned. And you could go on and on and on. But this desire for the unearned is everywhere in life, everywhere in life. People mind the suffering of their ancestors in an attempt to get money in the here and now. What rating do you give to Just Poor? For me, it was a 10 out of 10. Yes, I do give Just Poor a 10 out of 10. Just finished The Future and first time on live stream. Thank you and welcome. The egg came first. Just Poor, this is the novel of mine. You can get it for free at justpoornovel.com. Just Poor is a 10 out of 10. I keep thinking about the characters and plot, and I ask myself who these people are. Then remember, they're in a novel. They were as real to me, they were more real to me than people. Like the characters in my novel, certainly back before I was married, the characters for me in my novel were way more real than the people in my life. Because I could get genuine knowledge about the people in my novels, the characters in my novels. I could get genuine knowledge because I'm an omniscient author, right? I could get genuine knowledge about the people in my novels. If they were sad, I could know why they were sad and know what was happening. When a lot of people are sad, they'll never tell you the truth about it. So I could trust the characters in my novel because I could step through the flesh prison of the skull and I could go through the bone into the brain. And because I had the inner thoughts of the characters, I knew exactly who they were and there was no falsehood. It was a union of minds that was truly spectacular to me, and one of the reasons that I missed fiction so much. Now, I get that union of the minds with the call-ins and with these conversations, but really with the call-ins, but it's not quite the same because I have to go and get information from people I'm having the call-in show with. But when it comes to the characters, they volunteer to me information, and it is as close as I could get to anyone was writing. As close as I could get to anyone prior to meeting my wife. Let's see here. What do I think of South Park? I mean, it's nihilistic garbage for the most part, isn't it? I mean, it's not as bad as Beavis and Butthead, which is truly incomprehensible. I don't know. Do you think he'll ever write another novel as good as The Future? Absolutely. I absolutely will. If The Future's my best novel, and I think in many ways it is, why not just keep getting better? There's this argument, you know, that the fluid intelligence of your late teens and your early 20s, I'm blowing past 15 years of peak productivity, right? This is what a lot of people get, 15 years of peak productivity, you know, 15 to 30 or, you know, 25 to 40 or whatever. I'm blowing past that. And I feel that philosophy is such an endless fountainhead that there's no limit on what you can do. Because a lot of people say, well, look, if you want to be a famous scientist, you want to be a big scientist. If you haven't done it by 25, it's not going to happen. Because it's not like you're getting smarter. You may be getting more experience. But there's this argument that fluid intelligence, you know, musicians and poets, and so they have to do their best work when they're very young, and then they don't. And the desert of creativity that artists sit at, like I've been watching a little bit of Fawlty Towers with my wife and daughter, and John Cleese, like, when was the last time he did something new and funny? Fish Called Wanda, maybe? I don't know. It's like, that was in the 90s, wasn't it? It's a long, long, long number of decades. So I've always hated the idea of being post-creative, in the same way I've really hated the idea of being post-fit. And so I will resist aging with exercise and diet, and I will resist the dry, sad desert that waits for people who burn up their creative juices without replenishing them through virtue. Ooh, horrifying. To be post-creative, to me, would be like being post-life. So, what do you think goes through the spherical, blue-haired, tattooed women who are very unattractive but think they deserve to not work and get 10 out of 10 husband who does everything for them? Right, right. People, okay, you ready to have your minds blown? Here we go. People who set their sights too high are saying no to something. So people who say, I'm only going to date a 10 when they're a 5, are saying, I don't want to date. But they don't want to admit to themselves that they don't want to date. So let's say that you're a woman, and when you were a girl, you were sexually abused. 1 out of 3 girls, 1 out of 5 boys. Definitely among the people who are watching and listening to this, there's quite a few of you, and I have nothing but sympathy. It was very close to me once. Whew, dodged that bullet. But this is what the devil, let's personify him for a moment. This is what the devil does. Now, if you grow up and you were sexually abused as a child, you're going to have huge challenges when it comes to the free, spontaneous exhibition of sexual desire, of physical touch, of romance, of carnal knowledge, and so on, right? Not insurmountable, but it's going to be a challenge. Now, if you identify clearly that you were sexually abused, and this gives you, and it's all just my opinion, right? But if you identify clearly that you were sexually abused, and this gives you sexual touch and intimacy issues, then with that clear identification, you get to work, right? You find a good therapist, you journal, you get angry at the people who failed to protect you, you get enraged and probably psychologically murderous towards the person who raped and assaulted and abused you as a child. And you deal with it. And then you can emerge from that whole, perhaps even with a deeper and greater appreciation of sex, intimacy, romance, and sensuality. Now, if you had a parent or parents whose sole stated absolute job was to protect you, to protect you, provide and protect. That's the job of the parents, provide and protect. Do they want you to process emotionally, to process the experience and horrors of having been sexually abused? They do not. Why do they not want you to process that? Because you're going to get mad at them for failing to protect you. You're going to get mad at the parents, your parents, for failing to protect you as a child. So there's a huge, 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 huge pushback against, we'll just talk about women since it's more common among women. There's a huge pushback against actually processing the effects of sexual abuse. Huge pushback against it. I mean, just go and watch this incredible documentary called An Open Secret. I had the director on the show some time ago. Go and watch the documentary An Open Secret. So there's a huge pushback against processing sexual abuse. Processing, the actual processing of sexual abuse goes against the agenda to keep fathers out of the household so that boys are raised weak and hedonistic and girls are unprotected. Because, as I've talked about a million times on the show, children in single mother households where there's a non-related biological male living there are over 30 times more likely to be abused. Not just sexually abused, but abused in general. So shattering the family, exposing children to predators is all part of weakening society. So if, but it all relies upon the children not processing the sexual abuse. There's this dam holding back this ocean of tears related to sexual abuse in society. There's this massive dam, massive dam. You can see it with the Ghislaine Maxwell trial, the only woman to be convicted of sexually trafficking underage girls to absolutely no one, apparently. Certainly pretty sure they're not Republicans, or that would be all over the news. So there's this huge dam, this wall of oceanic tears, anger and horror at the prevalence of sexual abuse, which I believe has increased in society because of the splitting of the family. The absence of the male, largely male protectors of the children. Safest place for children to be, you know, is in a two-parent household. Married, two-parent household. So you've got this massive wall. Now, there's this huge reservoir of pain that people are not being encouraged, instructed, empowered to process. Why? The parents don't want it processed because you get mad at the parents. The schools don't want it processed because there's way more sexual abuse in government schools than there ever was per capita in the Catholic Church or other churches. Way hundreds of times more sexual abuse that occurs in government schools. The schools don't want it. Did the political leaders want it? Not if they went to Epstein Island or knew about it or whatever, right? So also, repressed pain diverts to ideology. Boom, ready? Repressed pain diverts to ideology. If someone has been abused, significantly and seriously abused as a child, if they don't process that abuse is the pain, the anger, the rage is easily harnessed and diverted into politics, into ideology. So the ideologues that want to harness and direct people to act out rage, anger, entitlement, they desperately don't want people to process their psychological pain. Because that unprocessed, untapped reservoir of psychological pain and anger can be very easily channeled into political activism, into targeting your political enemies. And you see this all the time happening in the world. Let me tell you about a dream I just had this morning. So I dreamt I was with my family. It was a sandy area. You have a beach and then it goes up to bluffs and then there's this tufts of like long grass and all of that and it goes back a ways. It wasn't on the beach. It was back up on the, I don't know what it's called, but the taller shelf area with the leaves and the grass and so on. And we were kind of playing around and then I noticed some people were using a machine to dig down. Now, I was joking with my daughter. Well, the last time we were at a beach, I was joking with my daughter about, and I said, look, We could see this everywhere we walked. I said, okay, we walk up the beach, we'll look for our shells and have a good chat. And I said, but here's something interesting. Look at the boys and the girls, the men and the women. And I want you to see how many people of which sex are sunning themselves and how many people of which sex are digging holes. Right? Because, you know, you're a boy. What do you do when you get to the beach? Well, you splash around like crazy for a long time, and then you start digging to China. That's your thing, right? And you make the channels, and you build the sandcastles. And, you know, it was true. Like, everywhere we went up, the women were sunning themselves, and the men and the boys were digging. So maybe it has something to do with that sort of memory or whatever. But so they started having this machine that would dig down. And it dug down, and I went back to playing or whatever I was doing. And I came back because I was kind of curious. And I said to myself, I wonder how deep this thing goes, because I, you know, seem to be going down a long way. So I got closer. Now, of course, it's real tough to get close to the edge of a big hole in sand that's just been dug, because it's going to shift and you're going to slide down into the hole, right? So I kind of crept forward, and my friends and family were like, whoa, 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 careful. And I'm like, yeah. Curiosity killed the cat, but satisfaction brought him back. And I went up to the edge of the hole. And I leaned over, and I was really, really alert to the shifting sand, right? And what could be, I leaned over, and I looked down, and you know, the further, like, 1 inch can give you another 100 meters or 200 meters down if you get the angle right. And I looked down, and I got to the edge of where I could feel safe without sliding into the hole, and I looked down, and it's like, oh my God, I can't see the bottom. What the hell are they doing? Why would they be digging in sand that deep? Weird, alarming. So then I edged my way back from the shifting sands at the edge of the hole. I got up and I saw cracks appearing on the beach. You know, the sand sifting down, just gaps and cracks appearing on the beach. And I screamed to everyone I knew and everyone I didn't know, get off the beach! Now! Get off the beach! And we didn't even grab our stuff. We just sprinted off the beach, and the cracks were forming, and right. And then, you know how these transitions occur in dreams? You know it's related, but you don't remember one scene to the next, but you know they're part of a continuity. So then I was in one of these, like, you know, whenever there's a Bond movie or something, there's this underground lair. They made fun of it in The Simpsons once. There's this underground lair. And I was in one of these underground lairs, and there was, like, corridors and all that. And I was there with my family, and there were people running towards us. And it looked like a zombie movie in a way. It's people running towards us. I think there might have been sand sifting down, but I'm not sure if that's a retroactive memory. And the people who were running towards us were alarming because their heads were flapping. And I was like, what does that mean? What's going on? So I looked at them, and they were physical bodies, human bodies, but their faces, like, you know, when you're a kid and you draw those lollipop people and there's that head, just a circle with two dots and a mouth, their heads were two-dimensional paper drawings of lollipop heads. A little alarming. But now, they weren't threatening. They weren't yelling, we're going to get you. They weren't chasing them weapons. They're just running towards us. It's lollipop people. And then I saw behind them, there were people who had human heads, but lollipop bodies. Two-dimensional, skinny lollipop bodies. And they were getting closer and closer. Now, I was close to waking. You ever have this where you wake up a little bit too early and you're like, oh, I could use another half hour. I could use another 45 minutes. That's going to be different. The difference between an 8-day and a 10-day in terms of happiness, right? So, but what you do is you kind of, you know, like you get these rocks and you whip them at the lake and they bounce, 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 bounce. I think I got 11 once. Pretty good at rock skipping. Anyway, so that's your dream. Like you just skip, 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 skip. You bounce asleep, you bounce awake, you bounce asleep, you bounce awake. And your dreams are very vivid and very easy to remember. So in the dream, whereas in the underground facility, looking down the corridor at the lollipop people running at us, I was just like, nope, not going to do it. And I made myself wake up. Like, I knew I was sleeping. I knew I was asleep at this point. I knew I was dreaming. And I was like, nope, not going to do it. Time to wake up. And I made myself wake up. Dreams can mean a lot of things. But I think the ocean to me has always meant the unconscious. It's where we came from. It's bigger than the land, bigger than the conscious mind. It's full of strange, wondrous, terrifying, beautiful creatures. It's the source of all life. Without it, we would die. So the sea, this is not my particular thing, right? But the sea has always meant the unconscious for me. So I'm close to the unconscious, which is where I want to be. I want to be close to the unconscious so I get its harness, its 8,000 times faster than the conscious mind power, but not into the unconscious completely, because then you just end up like a primitive ape. Like, you just project and defend and everything's the hedonism of the moment, and you don't have any larger universal plans or schemes or ideas or ideals. You're not fully human in the way that I would understand it. So you want to be near the unconscious, but not under the water. So digging down. Oh, and I also remember, sorry, I remember when I was looking at it, when the cracks were appearing in the cracks were appearing on the beach, on the sand, in the sand. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I should make some phone calls. This is kind of terrorism, right? This kind of, like, I should make some phone calls because maybe they can turn off the power of this thing that's drilling down. But that thought was lost in the panic of get off the beach. So I think when I was younger, the propaganda didn't hit till university. And I remember that very clearly. Like, when I was growing up, you learned your reading, your writing, your arithmetic, and so on. But there really wasn't any political propaganda when I was growing up. And I went to a bunch of different schools in a bunch of different countries. But by God, now, monstrous, the propaganda. So I think the drill down is going real deep. And that's why you have these two-dimensional, like, propaganda and ideology is two-dimensional. It's not rich, it's not deep, it's not powerful, it's not human. It turns people into these flat lollipop characters. Their heads have been replaced by lollipop heads. And I think that's how deep down, the drill down of the propaganda is, how deep down into the unconscious. People aren't being affected by propaganda anymore. They're being formed by propaganda. They're being shaped and built. Propaganda used to be something that you would paint on an already existing vase or pot. But now propaganda starts so early that the propaganda is shaping the pot. The propaganda is the shapes the entire thing. Not something you apply later. So they're getting earlier and earlier and earlier down for the propaganda. And it's causing massive cracks on the surface of society. And that's what I think the dream was telling me. And this is why I don't do politics anymore, because politics is not about debate anymore. Politics is about trying to combat propaganda. And when people are propagandized too early, this is Yuri Bezmenov stuff, right? They become demoralized. And demoralized people, you can show them all the contradictory information you want, won't change anything. So the spherical blue-haired tattooed women think they deserve to not work and get out of 10 out of 10 husband. So why do they often appear overweight? Now, they're not the only people who were significantly overweight, but that's the thing, right? So they're set up to be traumatized and not process their trauma, so they end up as useful people for propagandists. They are weaponized emotional trauma. And it's weaponized because it's not processed. It's not absorbed. It's not accepted. It's not integrated. Trauma is there to bring you to safety. But if you don't identify the accurate source of your trauma, you can't ever get to safety. If you can't ever get to safety, you constantly feel anxious, upset, angry, enraged, and you're very easy to mold into weaponized activism. So if somebody is traumatized, let's say, I'm not saying all these women were sexually abused, but let's say a woman is sexually abused, she won't process it, she can't process it, she's instructed and committed not to process it. Now, how do you get someone to not process their trauma? Well, if you divert their trauma into activism and you make it a moral virtue, get angry, tear down the system, whatever, right? Then for them to process their trauma feels like a betrayal of a moral cause. So you have to then, if a woman is traumatized as a child, in particular sexual abuse, what you have to do to maintain their weaponized status for the purposes of activism, political dismantling of society, what you have to do is you have to keep her away from situations that will really trigger her. And if you were sexually abused as a child, your parents don't want you in a romantic relationship because you're going to get into a romantic relationship, you're going to have flashbacks, you're going to get angry, you're going to be upset, you're going to realize how badly you were treated, you're going to realize how badly your parents protected you or how they didn't protect you at all, or maybe even delivered you consciously or unconsciously to a sexual predator, right? You know, pedophile. So it's a painful thing for you, and it could be enormously destructive to your entire society that let this happen, locally and even institutionally. So how do you prevent this woman, these women, from being triggered to the point where they start to integrate their trauma and actually blame the people who failed to protect them? Well, what you do is you say to these women to be unattractive is a virtue. Beauty is a bourgeois, capitalist, white supremacy virtue that enslaves women, and you gotta shave your head and blue hair and obesity doesn't find fat acceptance because you need to keep them away from sexual intimacy, otherwise their trauma will be triggered and they're no longer useful for purposes of activism. And this is why you see, this is very, very common. There's been this process. You can see this, the before and after pictures of university students, right? The women are programmed to be as unattractive as possible to keep them away from the trauma that would heal them so that they remain useful for purposes of political activism. All right, hope that helps. I am afraid I'm a little bit behind. Jump to recent messages. Quite a few new ones. Let me just go back and make sure I got everyone. Thank you. That was a long bit, but I think Ghislaine Maxwell is now on suicide watch. Yeah. Would you classify early exposure to pornography as abuse? Absolutely. All right. Sorry. Okay. Let me just get caught up here. What do you think about people who believe absolute truth is unattainable? Well, they're living a contradiction that serves their emotional needs. But it's so easy to unravel. It's not even a moment's thought. Is it absolutely true that absolute truth is unattainable? Okay, we have one. Maybe there's one. There might be more. Artists on drugs burn out, but not healthy, functional people. Yeah, I think that's kind of true as well. So an artist who wants to overcome his inhibition, or, you know, John Lennon was famously had terrifying stage fright. And I assume part of the drugs that he took was to do that. Also, artists are greedy to get their careers going fast, so they tour like crazy, which is another reason why particular performing artists like musicians and so on, they turn to drugs, in part because you've got to be on. You've got to be on. You've got 10,000 people paying $50 a head. That's $500,000. That's a lot of money. Can't mess that up, and you may be sued if you do a bad show, like if you don't have energy or whatever, right? Although Men at Work was famously mannequins when they played, right? So artists tour too much. I mean, singers blow their voices out all the time because they tour too much. The singer for Just a Small Town Girl Living in a Lonely World, that guy, I can't remember his name, but Journey, was it Journey? Yeah, quit the whole biz, and they got some guy from the Philippines who won a sound-alike contest to be the singer in the band, right? So, and Freddie Mercury got nodules in the early 70s. He was touring so hard. And in fact, one of the reasons he sounded so good on later tracks was because he'd stopped touring because of his illness and all of that. So, yeah, it was rough. And, you know, Queen, it's so wild that Queen never made any money from their tours. Just because they spent all their money on the actual tour. But it was for promoting albums and so on. So if you're greedy to get your career going, then you'll tour too much, and you'll get exhausted, and you'll get burned out and tired and all of that, and because you're greedy, right? Not taking up, pacing yourself. Let's see here. Can you rank or criticize based on show's value, occupations, educations of potential wife, packing order of women in terms of wife material? Please repeat the basics, how to advise, help a girl, what girlish moral to learn slash do. Yeah, it's interesting. That's interesting. It's a good question. So, if I was a young man and I was looking for a wife, I would certainly not date any woman who was going through an arts degree. That's straight up propaganda. So either she notices it's propaganda and is willing to just, I don't know what, lie to get a degree, to parrot whatever, or she doesn't even know that it's propaganda, in which case she's going to be highly, highly dangerous. Highly dangerous. You know, one of the ways that you destroy a culture is you make the women as unattractive as possible to the men, and what you do is then teach them that all the men are privileged. Well, wait a minute, 98% of workplace deaths are men. Doesn't matter. All men are privileged. Wait a minute. Only men really get drafted to fight in wars. No, all men are privileged. Wait a minute. Men die earlier than women. No, all men are privileged. Wait a minute. 95% of the prisoners in jails are men. No, all men are privileged. Right? So you make women hostile towards men, which makes women unappealing to men and kills the birth rate. And it's all very sinister stuff, of course, as you know. So I would not date a woman who was in the arts. Now, if she was in the arts like a guerrilla, so to speak, like she was going in to learn the ways of the enemy, and I don't know, like something like that, maybe fairly unusual, but I guess it could be the case. I would look certainly for a woman who was in a more objective field, like an engineering or, and the law schools are totally woke these days, but I mean, I don't know, training to be an airline, I don't know. But then the problem is that the more that she's in university for some more practical field, the more she's going to want to delay childbirth and having children. And that's a drag. I mean, you know, one of the things that was a bit of a shame in my life was one kid, right? Love her to death. Wonderful. If I'd had choice, it would have been more, but sometimes the fates work against you that way. So I would, like, the more she's dedicated to her education, the more she's going to want to use that education by going out and having a career rather than having children. And again, if I were a younger man, I would want to have children younger. And it's another reason why I exercise and eat well, is because it's not my daughter's fault that she has older parents. So sort of stay alert. I don't want her, you know, her 20s to be consumed by worries about failing health of parents or anything like that. So I would look for a woman who was entrepreneurial. I would look for a woman who was really thinking outside the box. I would look for a woman on a farm. I would look for a woman, something like that. A woman who was into some sort of agoristic alternative economy or something like that, so that she wasn't doing the regular train tracks. Because the regular train tracks of post-secondary education, post-high school education, either lead to somebody who's been propagandized into really terrible ideas, or it leads to someone who wants to delay fertility indefinitely. So that's what I would do. All right, so let's see here. My daughter goes to 3-year-old kindergarten. They're already propagandizing them. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And there's really not much you can do really about that. Let's see here. How in the actual F-U-C-K is there so much child sexual abuse in the world? How can there be so much wrong with so many people? Well, I think it kind of spreads on its own, right? I mean, if you target, I mean, a predator of this kind can target hundreds of children over the course of his life, and a significant proportion of those may grow up to have tendencies that way. So it spreads that way. And doesn't child abuse destroy your brain and can't be fixed? God, I hope not, because I think my brain's pretty fixed and I was severely abused as a child. No, I've got a Bomb in the Brain series, right? Self-knowledge, commitment to virtue, talk therapy with a good therapist can be absolutely fantastic. So yes, can be fixed. Show them all the evidence you want. You won't change anything. That's right, Steph. People are evolved to self-deceive. No, we're not. What are you talking about? Sorry, that's just so biologically irrelevant and uneducated. I don't even know what to say. People are not evolved to self-deceive. People are evolved to survive. And if self-deception is the price of survival, most people will choose self-deception over survival. So no, people are evolved to survive. If they're in an environment where honesty and integrity and virtue help their survival, they will do that. If they're in a situation where you have to lie and betray and deceive yourself, then they will evolve, right? Just evolve to survive, that's all. Let's see here. Let me get caught up here. Am I able to listen to this local stream somehow with screen off? I think on a PC you can, but I don't think it works on others. Oh, somebody says, yes, just leave it running in the background. Well, I guess that's the answer. Or just change your settings to leave the screen on. Right? Just need to turn the brightness down if your battery's low. All right. Hey, Steph, how do you deal with being black-pilled? I'm going through a black-pill phase at the moment. So the black pill is there's no hope, there's no future, and so on, right? I mean, to me, the only cure for the black pill is to extend your time frame. I mean, one of the things that my novel, The Future, was for me is to extend the time frame, to recognize that things are going to get much worse before they get better, but they will get better. Because the example of things going bad does educate people in the future. Sometimes the suffering is massive body count. Sometimes the suffering is lengthy economic malaise. But people do learn, eventually. You can fool some of the people, blah, blah, blah. So we've already gone through the education about fascism and National Socialism, right? Fascism and Nazism. So there was a war, Second World War, fascists and the Nazis against the free world allied with the totalitarian communist world, right, in Russia. Now, the fascists and the Nazis lost not just the war, but they lost their reputation for all time. The communists did not lose the war, and through infiltration, and right, they have maintained their reputation. I mean, think of the number of movies that Hollywood has made about Hitler or Nazism or the evils of Nazism or fascism versus the number they've made about the evils of communism and so on, right? In fact, I mean, this is, Ayn Rand was testifying against this, that there was all of these movies made in the Second World War and shortly thereafter completely praising communism and the Potemkin villages and so on, right? This is what McCarthy was really sort of fighting against. So, you know, that old song, two out of three ain't bad. Well, so fascism, which is corporate totalitarianism, it's corporations united with the power of the state, is kind of where we're at now. But fascism as a concept, National Socialism a concept, have been discredited, thankfully. And, you know, two down, one to go. We just have to do the same with socialism / communism. How much suffering will people have to go through before these ideas get discredited? I don't exactly know. It can't really be calculated. But you put the truth out there, and there is a time when the truth is like a giant laser target on your head, right? You're telling the truth, making the case, bringing facts to the world, and it gets progressively more dangerous. This is part of my dream, right, where I was looking down the huge hole being drilled into the beach or being scoured out in the beach. It wasn't drilled. There wasn't a drill going down. It was like a sort of circular machine that was digging out below. So when I was looking right down into the depths, that's a very slippery slope. You can fall down, and right, lots of thinkers who tell the truth too much, it blows back on them and things go very badly for them. And I think that's why I'm like, pull back, right? That's why I pulled back a couple of years ago. I mean, I view my brain as a sort of collective resource, if that makes any sense. I mean, I'm very lucky to have the language and reasoning skills that I have. I've earned shaping them, but that's like saying, well, a really good singer goes to a lot of singing lessons. It's like, well, yes, but they go to a lot of singing lessons because they're very good singers. It's a bit circular, right? So I view my brain as a collective resource that is not just mine, obviously, right? Not just for the benefit of me, but for the benefit of the world as a whole. It's not a UPB thing. It's not a moral thing. It's a, I'm lucky, and I think that the luck that I have can do the world a lot of good. And so I view it as a collective resource not to be squandered for the sake of immediate effect in the here and now. Okay, I don't have that right to squander this accidental brain for the sake of the immediate political effect or whatever in the here and now. That's not going to look at, it's a long game, right? So the black pill happens when you realize that in the short run, things get worse. But you have to zoom out. You have to zoom out and say, okay, well, in the long run. So you get attacked for telling the truth in the short run. And this happens repeatedly throughout history all the time. You can read about it, and I've read about it many times. In fact, it's in one of the central themes of Just Poor. Just Poor, this is very at the beginning. So Just Poor is a novel that takes place in the late 18th century about a brilliant girl in the middle of nowhere. And the local lord comes by with all these new ideas about how to make new crops and winter crops and turnips and crop rotation and more manure, and he really wants to improve the agriculture. Because he said, I just came back from Italy and I learned all of these fantastic things about agriculture, and we can really expand the food that we create and make money. And there's a girl at the table, a very pretty girl at the table, who says, oh, man, I've always wished to go to Italy. I always wanted to go to Italy. And the Lord laughs at her and says, you know, you play your cards right, girl, you just might. And Mary, who's the brilliant girl, just stands, jumps up and says, oh, is that how you got to Italy? Did you play your cards right? Is that what happened? You just played your cards right? And she could have done the same? No, that's not why you got to Italy. You got to Italy because you have coercive power over these lands and jail people who disagree with you. That's how you got to Italy. Is she right? Yeah, kind of. But that sets in motion the events of the book. How much truth can the world handle? Well, it was more when I was younger. It's less now. And it doesn't look like that's about to reverse, but there's always a bounce to these things. I was playing pickleball the other day. We were playing to 11. My partner and I were down 8-0, 9-0. And he's like, that's bad. I said, the tide will turn. And then we ended up losing, but only by one or two points. So it's like if you're in a board game with dice, like I like playing Catan these days. So you're in a board game with dice, right? And you built on, you need a 5, a 6, and a 7, and they're just not getting rolled. Well, you can get mad, of course, you know, sometimes it can be frustrating. But it just means they'll get rolled more later because things tend to even out. So the pendulum, right, it shifts. So you got to zoom out. You got to zoom out. If you zoom out, everything looks better. Now, the zooming out is probably going to be past my lifetime and probably past your lifetime as well. So what we need to do for the future is to put the truth out now in a way that doesn't get us killed, right? You're going to put the truth out now so that it's available as a map in the future, right? It's available as a map in the future, right? What do pirates do? They create treasure maps and they hide those treasure maps. So that means that later on people can go and find the treasure. Now, we have this incredible technology called the internet where things can be out there and around forever. So we're drawing a map called here's what went wrong and here's how to fix it. But however you draw that map, it could be in your own journal. It could be somewhere online. It could be in conversations. Keep, even if it's just for you for now, right? Here's what went wrong and here's how to fix it. That's my novel, The Future, which is the only utopian novel that I know about. It's the only utopian science fiction novel that I know about. So, just zoom out. It's always earlier than you think. Right? So if you're in the freedom movement, philosophy movement, UPB movement, it's always earlier than you think because you're surrounded by people who agree with you, so you think you're further along and you go back out into the world. Right? So, I'm going to Red Hot Chili Peppers. It's 50,000 people for $250 a head. Yeah, that makes a philosopher feel just wonderful. My 36-year-old son won't reply to my messages. Has completely cut me off. I will send him birthday and Christmas presents. Should I do this? I don't think so. I don't know what you should do, but I'm telling you what I would do. What I would do is, okay, you must know why he's cut you off. Right? I'm sorry that it's happened, but you must know why. Or at least have some idea why. And if he's cut you off because, let's say, he had issues with your parenting and you didn't listen to him and you got mad, I doubt that's the case. But if he did that, you know why he cut you off. If he cut you off because he married Meghan Markle, he got involved with some kind of ideologue who's going to turn him against his family or whatever, then that's a different matter. Okay, well, how was he susceptible to that? And did you work to try and prevent that from coming about and so on, right? So if you send him birthday and Christmas presents, you are not respecting his desire to not have contact, because that's a kind of contact. So in my opinion, or what I would do, would be to send him messages every once in a while saying, I absolutely, completely, and totally want to talk about what happened. I miss you. But don't say things like, I'm sorry for whatever happened, because that's manipulative, right? Because you know what happened, if you're the parent. And if you don't know what happened, that's not good, right? If you don't know what happened with your own child and why they're not being in contact with you, that means you have a very distant relationship, or you don't notice things that are happening with your child. I don't know what to do about that. So no, I would indicate your willingness to talk to him. And also what I would do, this is something that parents who have children who have separated from them could do, and just if you could go to talk therapy, because it's a traumatic thing to have your parents, to have children not want to talk to you, it's very tough, right? So if you go to talk therapy and you start to work on how you were as a parent and what went on with your kid and all that, well, you can at least say, listen, I've just spent 3 months in therapy, I've spent 6 months in intensive therapy, I've really learned a lot, and I do have a lot to talk about. I do have some stuff to apologize for, and I really want to hear. Then you've done something practical to try to learn about what happened and so on. That there's a new variable or factor, which is you've done therapy. So why do you think tech is having hiring freezes? What do you think is happening in the industry? Could it be because tech has gone woke? Yeah, I mean, tech gets massive subsidies from government contracts, so they don't have to be efficient. And woke is just a weird luxury that you have when you don't need a meritocracy. And you don't need a meritocracy because you're getting free money printed off from the government. And, you know, there is a general IQ drop and all of that. So, yeah, it's just getting, you know. Hello from Australia. Men at work rule. I like men at work. The singer from Men at Work, he's a very funny guy. Colin Hayes, I think his name is. He's a very funny guy, and he did a show where he did comedy and all of that with his songs, and a good singer too. A nice little warble in his voice. And I prefer Be Good. And he does some pretty good sea shanties, believe it or not. Anyway, so Colin James was talking about in LA. He said, in LA, nobody laughs. They just say, you're really funny. You're a funny guy. But nobody actually laughs. I remember that. It's kind of a good thought. Steph, how many kids too much? I understand money plays a role here, but I would like a framework to answer this question myself. Well, I think you want to have enough kids that you can at least have a one-on-one once a week. So if you have, I don't know, 20 kids or whatever, you probably can't do that, right? So if you have so many kids that you can't give them any kind of individualized moral instruction on any regular basis, that may be too many. All right, let's see here. Peter Schiff's bank got shut down. Yeah, I think he went to Puerto Rico for some reason, maybe taxes or whatever. And yeah, he's having some rough stuff with the banking system down there. But he said he had to put $7 million US into his bank. I saw this somewhere, or somebody sent it to me. They put $7 million into some bank because of bad press about Peter Schiff. So yeah, it's rough. It's rough. It's a very, very difficult situation. A reputation destruction is essential for physical destruction. All right. I went to art school. Steph's intuition is bang on. Well, I went to theater school too, right? All right. Steph, even though you only got to have one child, you convinced many listeners to have children or have them earlier. Yeah, no, that's great. I'm very happy about that. I think that's wonderful. But I still would have liked more. All right. What was your favorite part of being a father to an infant? Oh, man, infants are so much fun. I can't wait for the grandpa phase. Infants are so much fun. They're so full of joy. They're so full of curiosity. And they're so strong-willed. I mean, seeing a human being in its original alpha state with that incredible curiosity, that incredible will to learn, to explore, to grow, to master. Fantastic. I've told this story before, but I remember my daughter, very, very high stimulus. Boy, I don't know where she gets that from. But when she was, even as a newborn, she would never sit on my lap. Never. She'd never. If I sat on my lap, she'd start fussing and crying. And I didn't know what to do because, you know, I was chatting with her and, you know, whatever, patting her back. And the only thing that would make her happy was I had to pick her up and walk around the room and walk around the house and show her things. Here's a picture. Here's a mantelpiece. This is a television, you know, and explain to her. And if she was moving around and looking at new things, she was happy as a clam. But when she was sitting, not happy. And she was, she's always been she's a very good-natured, very even-tempered person. I probably gets that more from my wife than from me. Well, maybe the parenting. But she was very giggly, but you really had to earn it. Like you really, I saw some video of a guy going, right? And some kid giggling away. My daughter would never giggle at that kind of stuff. But I remember standing with a spray bottle and spraying in my face and then being surprised that it happened, which made her laugh. But here's the funny thing, the laugh would diminish. I'd get maybe 5 minutes out of that and then she'd need something new. So she's got high standards, but she, when those standards are met, she's very peppy and positive. So yeah, the babies are just a blast. And they're so connected and they're so, you let them be who they are. They will teach you a lot about what it means to be present and human in the moment and to have a strong will, to be unapologetic about your desires. It's a beautiful thing to see. It's a little painful at times when you realize how much we're mashed and broken often, but it's a beautiful thing to be around. Those given much, even in intelligence, have a responsibility to spread it to others. Thanks for doing that. You're welcome. You're welcome. It really is my pleasure. What do you think about the idea of God and the devil being personifications of good versus evil? Wouldn't this help cultural Christians? Well, I just wrote a whole book about this, the future. So I will let you enjoy that. Freedomain.locals.com. You can sign up and you can, you know what? I've got a thing. I might as well mention it. I think it's all this month. But I do have a promo code. Promo code. All right. So my promo code, if you want to sign up, you can try a month free on Locals. I want to make sure that I have the right thing here. Let me just look here. Because I really do want people to, you know, Locals is a great community. It's a great platform, really good conversations. And I really would recommend you check it out. So let me just get this sorted out. Sorted. Yes. Okay. So, I can edit this. Okay. So if you want, you can, well, let's do it, through the end of the week. Okay. So if you want to sign up, freedomain.locals.com, you know, remember this is 6th of July, 2022. So you can, let's give it for a week. So until the 13th, you can use a promo code, all caps, INDY2022, INDY2022, and you'll get a free month on Locals. And, you know, hopefully then you'll like it and you will continue. But when you get the free subscription supporting Locals, you get the book, The Future, which you can listen to or you can read on ebook format or whatever. So I hope that you will check that out. So Indie 2022, all caps, I-N-D-Y 2022, no spaces, no dashes, no hyphens or anything like that. So yeah, I hope that you will, I hope that you will check that out. It's a good community. It's a great platform. And you get to listen to what it is that I'm talking about with regards to my book, my masterpiece, at least the one so far. All right. All right. Oh, Georgia Guidestones are down. Yeah, I heard about that. Stefan, how do I get people to care about Western civilization? Most normies have encyclopedic knowledge about sports, but care nothing about serious issues. Well, you know, it's tough to get a doctor to care for a terminal patient. Western civilization, as it stands, isn't going to stand. Now, Western civilization includes, and has now for 150 plus years, government-run and controlled schools. Like, once you put the education of the young in the hands of the government, you've set the clock. You've turned over the hourglass, the sand is going through. That's just the way it is. That's just the way it is. So whatever is coming next is going to be something that either it's totalitarian or it's something without government-controlled schools, because that's what does it. I have started a voice-over business, recording audiobooks, ads, and tutorials. I constantly combat laziness and often wait until the last minute to finish a project. I find it easier to pull 60 hours a week at my normal full-time job, but wholly unfulfilling. I want to be an entrepreneur, but how can I rewire my brain to work as hard for my own business as I do for the crappy day job? Oh, that's easy. Oh, that's easy. It's so ridiculously easy to do what you want that I'll just tell you. I'm not even gonna hedge and dance around the topic. Quit your fucking day job, man. You quit your day job, you'll find yourself very focused on building your business. You got a foot in the pier, you got a foot on the boat, right? And they're going apart, right? So just quit your day job. You know, that's what I did. I mean, I don't want to say I'm like the measure of like all sensible things, but when I took a massive, a 75% pay cut to quit my career and start this show or work on this show. So yeah, did that make me committed? Certainly did. Once you're cornered, once you have no issue, then when the media attacked me as a cult leader, it's like, okay, well, I've really got to make this work because I can't go back to the business world now, can I? You guys really helped commit me. I'm very committed. So yeah, I don't understand, like, what's the challenge? You're not lazy because you're working 60 hours a week at your normal full-time job. So if you want to be an entrepreneur, sorry, I don't mean to laugh because it seems obvious to me. You want to be an entrepreneur? I've got an idea. Be an entrepreneur. How's that? How's that for an idea? You want to be an entrepreneur? Be an entrepreneur. That means quitting your day job, putting all your eggs in one basket. You'll be focused. You'll really work hard. And that's how you do it. I don't know any other way to do it. I mean, I've tried the two jobs thing, right? Before I co-founded the software company in the 90s, I was working a programming job at a big bank. And the business was trundling along, and it wasn't really satisfying. But, you know, because, you know, you get home, you're tired. You're working 60 hours a week, you're tired. So my business that I'd started on the side just trundled along. And then I was like, to hell with it, I could quit my job. And then it's pretty easy to grow that business, but you can't do both very easily. So yeah, just quit your job. If you can survive it, and if you can't survive it, then don't do two. Hey, Steph, your documentary on California was amazing. Could you do a documentary on Canada? Well, all things are possible under sun or moon. So I don't know. Hey, Steph, would you come back to Australia for a holiday? We'd love to have you around for dinner. Well, hopefully that's not Hannibal the Cannibal. No, that's very nice. I don't think so. It's a long flight, and I don't have the very best conceivable memories of us. Actually, I would say Australia was pretty cool. I really did like going to Australia. I loved giving those speeches. I do miss public speaking. It's just the way it is. But certainly had a better time there than I had trying to give speeches in Canada and failing, or trying to give speeches in New Zealand and failing because of bomb threats, death threats, and all that kind of stuff. So I have a much more favorable affection for Australia than for other places. So Yeah, it could happen one day, but it's a long way to go for a holiday. Do you have any thoughts on Erwin Schiff, Peter Schiff's dad? He was an interesting character. Objectively speaking, I think he was a fool, but Jordan Peterson often says that one must be willing to be a fool before being a hero. Yeah. So if I remember rightly, Erwin Schiff was one of the people who felt you didn't have to pay income taxes because there was some, I think, gosh, what was it? The most dangerous superstition author whose name escapes me at the moment, but... yeah, there's a lot of people who feel, well, I can find some legal shenanigans to, quote, prove that I don't have to pay income tax, and then they run up against the reality of power, and so I don't know. Steph, how do I overcome trauma from an abusive workplace? I want to get back into software programming, but whenever I sit down to write code or study for technical interviews, I get extremely anxious. I'm worried I'll just end up being mistreated again. Oh, just work for yourself. Yeah, just, I mean, listen, if you're listening to this show, I will encourage everybody to really look into entrepreneurship as a way of making a living, as best you can. So, do you believe there will eventually be Nuremberg-like trials over the COVID vaccination campaign? Oh, you mean for, like, violation of the Nuremberg Code? No. Steph, when you started your company, how did you decide to make environmental software? How does one find such opportunities? Well, it's networking, right? I had somebody who knew the environmental side of things and basically helped me with the design. I did all the coding, but all of that, so. Let's see here. We love you, Steph. We know the media are full of shit. They can get fucked. It's a strange job. How many months or years of savings did you have when you quit your job to do philosophy full-time? Not much. I mean, do you remember? So I took 2 years off to write Almost and to write Just Poor, and I took one of Canada's best writing programs and all of that. And I'll tell you, I won't get into names, but my very first writing teacher was unbelievably hostile towards my writing. My writing, people love it, or it just enrages them. There's almost nothing in between. So, all right. I would say having a good stash of savings, enough to last 6 months, would be a good idea before giving up the day job. Yeah, you know, I hear what you're saying, but... if you have more savings, you will work less hard, right? You know how these things work. My daughter and I were playing a game the other day, and we went into a super difficult level and just got slaughtered, right? So then I said, she's like, it's too difficult. I said, no, let's try again. There's an important lesson here. Let's try again. So we went in. We still got slaughtered, but it took a lot longer. And then we went in. We still got slaughtered, but it took even longer, right? And I said, so we're not getting more powerful. It's not getting easier. We're just more careful because we know it's more dangerous. So we're adjusting our behavior based upon the environment. So, you know, let's say you have 10 years of savings and you quit your job to do this entrepreneurial voiceover thing. What does that mean? I mean, we all know how, I mean, I know this is not the typical audience, right? But we all know what happens with these unemployment insurance schemes, right? Where the government gives you money for 6 months or a year if you lose your job or whatever, right? Well, what happens? We know if you get money for a year, you do nothing for 11 months and then you work like hell over the last couple of weeks to get a job, right? So you can say, well, you know, it'll be more secure. It's like, yeah, but the security comes from the hard work, not from the money. And the more money you have, the less hard work you're going to have. All right. Steph, why am I so afraid of losing my mother? The thought of her passing away brings me to tears every time I think about it. She is a single mother with multiple divorces, and I feel like I was somewhat neglected as a child. Ah, well, no, I can tell you why that's the case. See, it's funny because I put in the hedges like I don't know, but I know. So the reason why you're afraid of losing your mother, this is not your mother, you're afraid of losing. It's the hope that something's going to change so you don't have to deal with what happened as a child. I mean, for myself, fortunately, I had resolved things in my mind with regards to my father when he died over 2 years ago now, and his death really didn't hit me that hard. I tried my very best to have a positive relationship with him. I told him the truth about what happened to me as a child, and he didn't want to talk about it, so... You know, when you don't have a functional relationship with someone, them being in the world or not, it matters to them, matters to their friends or whatever, but as far as like, what's the practical difference? What's the practical difference if I'm not talking to my father, whether he's alive or not? For me, right? Obviously, sympathy for him and his family and all that. But so it's not that you're afraid of losing your mother. It's that your mother being alive gives you the hope that something's going to change. But when she dies, you'll actually have to deal with what happened in your childhood, because the illusion that there will be change will no longer exist. So deal with it now. Lock and Rose, thank you. Thank you very much. And let's see here. For 3 decades, I've been self-employed. It is the only way to live. Any chance you can do a video on entrepreneurship? Yeah, maybe a roundtable or something like that. Thank you, I appreciate that. Question, hello, will my 401k be ruined by inflation and or government confiscation? I am 41 years old. Well, I'm 55 years old, and I'm not expecting a penny from the government when I retire. Not a penny. Not a penny. And, you know, it's hard right now. Listen, I'm not a financial advice guy, so it's all just my opinion. Don't do anything based upon what I'm saying. But it's pretty hard to find a good place to hedge inflation these days, right? If you've got cash, it's being bled dry by the vampires of central banking. If you've got real estate, the market's kind of shaky, although places with a lot of immigration are going to still steroid pump up the real estate values. Crypto is a mess at the moment because all of the speculators are being shaken off. And the, you know, I mean, I've seen crypto go down 80, 85%, right? From like over 20 grand down to 3 grand or whatever. So when it went from 80 down to 25 Canadian, it's like, okay, that's not 85%, right? I mean, that's not even 75%. So yeah, crypto is a bit of a mess as a hedge against inflation and real estate, you know, rates are going up, so it's tough. Cash is bad. Stocks and bonds are getting slaughtered. So yeah, it's honestly, I don't have any big answers about what to do with your money. They just discovered enough gold in Uganda to double the gold supply over time, which means America's probably going to rush in and save it from something. But yeah, it's rough. But this is why I think entrepreneurial is very important, because with entrepreneurial, you have the option to continue working fairly pleasantly past retirement, as long as you're entrepreneurial and something you enjoy. So, but yeah, I don't expect anything for retirement. A lion hunts best when it's hungry. Well, within limits. If it's too hungry, it has no calories to run with. But yeah, absolutely. Hello from Melbourne. Hello. Oh, you were saying hello to each other. All right. I'm just, you know, and those people wave hello across the street and you wave back and there's someone behind you. So. All right. Gemma O'Doherty is pretty rough for her in Ireland. And of course, she's not getting as much support from all of that state stuff that she should. So. All right. Steph, your insight about savings and hard work is spot on. I have a dream job. I'm a freelancer web developer. I can work whenever I want. The pay is good and all my current clients are pleasant people. But I've been struggling with productivity. I missed the drive I had back when I was at risk of not having a place to live. Do you have any advice? Well, it's not drive. There's panic. And you should, I think, in the long run, try to find something that drives you other than panic, right? Because panic is reactive. You want a joy or something that you can build that you want to share with the world that's proactive, not just reactive. So, all right. I got out of real estate because of government intervention. Oh, yeah, for sure. Real estate sales are down 41% where I am due to interest rate hikes. Yeah, for sure. How does one become a 21st century polymath? I don't know exactly, but I would assume it's just love, knowledge, and a wide variety of fields. And the last thing I'll say about this, listen, this is a real personal message to everyone out here who's listening to this. And this comes out of a conversation I had with a listener this week. I am so backed up on call-in shows. I have like 10 call-in shows that I haven't released as yet. But I consider vanity one of the greatest of sins. Then we know the vanity of like, well, I can be a central planner and run a multi-trillion-dollar economy from a desk and a calculator. We know that kind of vanity. We know the kind of vanity of like, I'm the greatest, I'm the best, I'm the prettiest, whatever, how destructive that can be. We know the vanity of bullies who are willing to unleash violence against free speech because they just believe that they're right and anyone who disagrees with them is evil, and that's vainglorious in the extreme and dangerously narcissistic extreme. So the greatest vanity that harms you, though, is not the vanity that thinks you're better,
but the vanity that thinks you're worse. It's the vanity that will really get you. So when I was younger, significantly younger, I did really make a vow to myself that I think has been the foundation of whatever success I've achieved. And that vow was, I'm never going to prejudge my limits. I'm never, ever, ever going to prejudge my limits. I'm never going to say, well, I can do this, but not that. Well, I can become this good, but not better. Well, I'm not going to put any limits, because that's real vanity. Real vanity is when you say, I know from the top of my brain to the bottom of my unconscious, everything that I'm capable of, everything that I could possibly do, everything that I could conceivably achieve. I know from here to eternity, everything that I can do. No, you don't. My God, do you ever not know that at all? You don't know. It is a form of vanity to place limits upon yourself for things you don't know. Now, things you do know, yes, you can put limits on yourself. I know I can't touch my toes with my legs straight. I never have, never will. I took years of stretching in theater school. I took gymnastics. I did dance. I did sword fighting. I did, you name it. Can't do it. I have Danny DeVito's hamstrings. What can I tell you? It's fine. So I know because I've tried. I know that I can't sing well enough to front a rock band. Why? Because I tried. I tried. Garage bands in my teens. Tried. I know that I can't be a professional dancer because I'm 55. Right? And other reasons. I know that I can't be a hair model. You understand, right? So when you've tried, yes, you can start to put limits on yourself. When you've really tried and given it your all. You know, I wrote and recorded a song or two when I was younger, listened to myself back. I'm like, it's okay, but it's not great. I mean, there's an incredible song. It's barely a song, really. It's piano plus a woman vocalizing with vowels. Called The Great Gig in the Sky. You've probably heard it if you've listened to, well, you have heard it if you've listened to the album Dark Side of the Moon. Now, the woman who did this, so I think it was the drummer who came up with the piano line. And they didn't know what to do with it. They tried throwing like astronaut speeches on it and stuff like that. They didn't really know. They knew that the piano line wasn't enough. But they needed to do something with it. So finally somebody said, well, why don't we just get a woman to vocalize over it? Just a woman to sing over it, right? I'm curious. And a famous engineer, Alan Parsons, who later did the Alan Parsons Project, whose song Sirius is fantastic, by the way. But yeah, Richard Wright is a chord progression, right? And what happened was they said, okay, let's just get a female singer. So Alan Parsons suggested this woman named Claire Torrey. She was a 25-year-old songwriter and a session vocalist. And Parsons had worked with her before, liked her voice and all that. So an accountant from the Abbey Road Studios contacted Tori and said, hey, come in tonight to sing for Pink Floyd. And she's like, no, I got a ticket to see Chuck Berry. No way. So between 7 and 10 p.m., they asked her to come in on the Sunday, right? So what happened? Pink Floyd played the piano track and said, can you improvise a vocal? Now, that's a kind of strange thing for a singer to hear, right? Can you improvise a vocal? Like, I don't know what you want exactly, right? And then she said, okay, well, what if I just pretend that I'm the instrument? And she did two takes of this. This blows my mind. Honestly, completely and totally blows my mind. And the second take, she got incredibly emotional. And she apologized for this. Oh, it's too emotional. Ugh. You know, and the band was like, no, that was great, all right? Like the singer's voice cracking in the back of that Rolling Stones track. Let It Bleed. Anyway. So I thought that the vocals were written down like notes, but this is just a woman completely improvising some of the most incredible and beautiful vocals. You got to listen to this song. It's unbelievable. Even the three singers who sing it on the Pulse Live Tour is pretty good, but this Claire Torrey was just unbelievably fantastic. Now, she tried Gilmore, I think, said do a third take, and she's like, no, no, no. She went through it, and halfway through she stopped. She said, no, I've lost it. I lost the feeling. I can't do it. So they put the final track together from the 2.5 takes or the 3 takes or whatever she did, right? So, you know, 15 minutes, boom, she's got the most incredible vocal, all improvised. And she did end up suing them later to, like, they paid her $30, right? And she didn't even know that she'd been included in the album until the album was for sale. And, oh, my name's on the credits. She ended up getting co-writing credit in the lawsuit from, like, 2005. So, unbelievable, right? Unbelievable. Fantastic stuff. I mean, that's as close to God as you're possibly going to get. It's just putting on some headphones, listening to a piano track, and outbursting from you Gabriel's trumpet of the most incredible, powerful, angelic vocals that God or man has ever put together. I had no idea that this was improvised. It unbelievably blows my mind that this was improvised. She's never had much of a career after that, but my God, in a sense, why would you even bother? So she just went in and it just came out of her. She hadn't sat there and think, oh, I should really vocalize with piano and just make up stuff as I go along because it's incredible, right? Please don't ever prejudge what you're capable of. Put everything you have into creating something. And if you put everything you have into creating something repetitively, and it's not great, it's not good, it's not inspiring, fantastic. Then you can say, I have that limit, I've explored it, I know where it is, that's fine. Maybe you can revisit it later or whatever. But don't ever, ever assume limitations, because that's to say you know what you don't know. You don't know your limitations, neither do I. You don't know them. Please, please, do not. Vanity is claiming knowledge, skills, abilities, or talents you don't have. Vanity is claiming knowledge you don't have, faking it. Putting limitations on yourself is claiming knowledge you don't have. Now, if you've explored it, you have the knowledge, fine. But don't do it ahead of time. Don't do it ahead of time. I've always said to myself, I can be the greatest. Can I be the greatest? Absolutely not. Not in everything, of course, right? But every time I go into something, I'm like, I'm going to be the greatest. It's like Schwarzenegger saying, you know, of course I'd run for president if I could. I mean, if you're going to be in something, why not aim for the top? Aim for the top. Yo, well, what if I don't get there? Well, you won't get there if you prejudge it. If not getting there is the worst thing in the world and you prejudge yourself as being unable to do it, for sure you won't get there. Absolutely guaranteed. Guaranteed. You won't get there. So, but what if I really, really strive and try to do it and I fail? Great. Then you've got knowledge and you're not faking it in the future when you say there are limitations. I still don't know what I'm capable of. I still wake up every day saying, what if I can do better? What if I know I can do better. I know I can do more. I know I could be better at communicating this. I can have better analogies. I can have better ways of writing and talking and communicating and reasoning and creating. Yes, yes, yes. That's the forever yes that you say to your own potential. Why not? Why not? You're going to die either way. You're going to die having stretched yourself to your greatest potential, or you're going to have a die hedging yourself. And you go into the fucking coffin like a little OXO cube of self-restraint. For what? The universe doesn't give you additional time and years for limiting yourself. You don't get extra. It's not like you squish something down and it gets longer. You don't squish down your potential and get a longer lifespan. You're dead either way. God, go for the top. Go for the greatest. Go for the best. And surround yourself with people who do the same thing. Absolutely, completely, and totally. Sorry that I'm out of time. There's a hard stop on 90 minutes here. Freedomain.locals.com. Please help out the show. Please help me out. I think I'm providing the greatest value that there is around. If I'm not, then please tell me how I can. I thank you so much for the opportunity to do this. I thank you so much for everyone dropping by with these great questions tonight. Freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Lots of love from up here. Take care, guys. Talk to you soon.